of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The AP's Jackie Quinn reports on the United Nations' highest court ordering Israel to clear the way for more aid to get into Gaza.
The top court of the United Nations has issued two provisional measures against Israel in the genocide case brought by South Africa. It's ordering Israeli officials to open more land crossings to allow food, water, fuel, and supplies into Gaza and to report back in a month. The European Union's also urging Israel to lift the roadblocks. Ireland's Deputy Prime Minister Micheál Martin says the food is there, it's just not getting in.
It is criminal. It's absolutely a scandal that children are malnourished, that half the population are facing famine.
Aid groups say complicated inspection procedures and continued fighting are delaying aid convoys. I'm Jackie Quinn.
AP correspondent Norman Hall now reports on the latest developments on the bridge collapse in the U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland.
The top court of the United Nations is...
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will use the largest crane on the eastern seaboard to help remove the wreckage of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge brought down by a cargo vessel. The machine can lift up to 1,000 tons. Governor Wes Moore says Maryland deeply appreciates support and the $60 million the federal government has provided so far. Moore says removing the wreckage and replacing the bridge will be extremely difficult.
We have a very long road ahead of us. We understand that, and we're preparing.
The port's closure has ships waiting offshore, drying up work for dock workers, and crippling regional shipping. I'm Norman Hall.
And for details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Haiti now needs between 4,000 and 5,000 international police to help tackle catastrophic gang violence, according to the UN rights expert for the conflict-racked Caribbean nation. William O'Neill spoke at a news conference launching a UN Human Rights Office report he helped produce, which called for immediate action to tackle the cataclysmic situation in Haiti, where corruption, impunity, and poor governance compounded by increasing gang violence have eroded the rule of law and brought state institutions close to collapse. The report, covering the five-month period ending in February, said gangs continue to recruit and abuse boys and girls, with some children being killed for trying to escape. AP correspondent Saga Magani reports a Russian veto means a panel of experts lose their mandate to monitor enforcement of nuclear sanctions against North Korea.
The sanctions themselves will stay in place, but the Russian veto means the panel's mandate will end next month.
Russia's been violating these sanctions, of course, for some time.
White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says Moscow's imported weapons from North Korea for use in Ukraine, and Western allies say Russia's veto was a bid to shield that.
Today's vote will only embolden the DPRK to act with further impunity.
Deputy U.S. UN Ambassador Robert Wood says Russia's looking to silence independent investigations of North Korean activities. Moscow's ambassador says the West is trying to strangle Pyongyang, and the sanctions are becoming both irrelevant and detached from reality. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The AP's Karen Chamas reports on a U.S. journalist who has spent 1 year behind bars in Russia on espionage charges.
Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich has marked a year behind bars in Russia after his arrest by Russian authorities. Guards take the American journalist from the notorious Lefortovo prison in a van for the short drive to the courthouse. The proceedings are always closed, his appeals are always rejected, and his time behind bars is always extended. Then, it's back to Lefortovo. His friend, Guardian reporter Pyotr Sauer, told the AP that Gershkovich is staying strong.
He remains hopeful for his release. He's not broken, neither physically or mentally. He's in good spirits.
His mother, Ella Milman, says she's proud of how her son is handling the situation.
He's standing there smiling, defiant. Head is up high.
Gershkovich was arrested on espionage charges a year ago while on a reporting trip in Yekaterinburg. I'm Karen Chamas.
And I'm Michael Brown. For more news, join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Friday, March 29th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Former South African President Jacob Zuma is disqualified from contesting the May 29th election.
Any person who was convicted of an offense and sentenced to more than 12 months imprisonment without the option of a fine. This disqualification ends 5 years after the sentence has been completed.
A bus accident killed 45 people in South Africa on Thursday. Togolese protest the new parliament-approved constitution. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu establishes a task force to deal with economic challenges facing the country.
A wide-ranging committee has the president himself as chairman working out a solution out of the economic challenges that this country is grappling with.
And a Kenyan healthcare business is using portable, low-cost ultrasound system to give expecting mothers a chance to see their babies. Those stories plus Tamsi O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former South African President Jacob Zuma is not allowed to contest for any seat or position in the coming national elections. This was announced by South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission on Thursday. Late last year, Zuma announced that he will no longer vote for his party, the African National Congress, but will rally behind the newly formed Nkuntu Wesiswe Party. Since then, he has become the face of the party. However, the electoral body has disqualified him because of his previous criminal record. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Speaking to reporters at a media briefing in Johannesburg on Thursday, the Independent Electoral Commission's chairperson, Mosotho Moebia, said it had received an objection against Zuma's name being included in the list of election contestants. Moebia explained that the commission upheld the objection in consideration of Zuma's past criminal record. In July 2021, Zuma was sentenced to 15 months imprisonment without the option of a fine for contempt of court. This was after he disregarded a constitutional court judgment ordering him to appear before a commission of inquiry investigating state capture and corruption that took place during his presidency. Muyebia read out to journalists Section 30 of the Electoral Act in conjunction with Section 47 and Section 106, describing persons who are not eligible to contest the elections.
Any person who was convicted of an offense and sentenced to more than 12 months imprisonment without the option of a fine. This disqualification ends 5 years after the sentence has been completed.
On Tuesday, the Electoral Court ruled that Zuma's Nkuntu Wesizwe MK was properly registered and will contest the coming elections. This was after the ruling ANC asked the court to deregister the party because its registration did not follow the proper procedures. Dyke Kutsie, professor of political science at the University of South Africa, explains what Zuma's disqualification means for him and his party.
It does not disqualify him from participating in the election campaign. So though he won't be able to stand as a candidate for parliament, he will still be able to continue as the face of the MK party.
Zuma has until Tuesday to challenge the commission's decision. Zuma and the MK party have not responded to this decision, but the Electoral Commission says they have been formally informed. However, MK Youth President Bonginkosi Kanyile has recently said they will resort to violence and disruptive behavior if Zuma is barred from contesting the elections on the 29th of May.
For this democracy, we defend it. We want to vote, put our X. That's all. And we'll do it. Further to that, there won't be declared elections.
Zuma is going to win the ballot.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has already warned that anyone caught disrupting the elections will be met by the full force of the law. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
45 people were killed on Thursday in South Africa when a bus plunged off a bridge and fell more than 150 feet. South African officials said only one person, an 8-year-old girl, survived the crash. Reuters news agency says the bus was traveling from Botswana to an annual Easter festival at a church in Moriah in South Africa's northern province of Limpopo. On the line from Johannesburg is reporter Tuso Kumalo, and good morning to you, Tuso. Just what caused the accident?
Quite a tragic accident. The actual cause, according to authorities, is still being investigated. But what we know for now is that it happened on a sharp bend. Hence, it is believed that the driver could have lost control when he was approaching a bridge that is on this bend. He then hit the barriers of the bridge sides, and this is when the bus then plunged down 50 meters into a gorge. Then on impact, it then burst into flames, killing about 45 people. What we know now is that only one 8-year-old survived with severe injuries, and she has been taken to hospital.
When did the accident happen? At night, or was this due to bad weather?
The accident happened during daytime. It was just midday to late afternoon, so visibility was not an issue here. This is why it is strongly believed the driver could have lost control. We don't know if the driver was speeding, but we know that this was a group of Christians from Botswana. They were attending a yearly gathering of the Zion Christian Church in a place called Moriah in the Limpopo province, north of the country. This is an event that attracts thousands and thousands of people every year, and unfortunately, every year it seems there are people who get killed or who die while traveling to the same gathering.
What are the authorities saying so far about the accident?
The Transport Minister, Sindiswe Chikunga, visited the scene soon after the accident happened. Coincidentally, when it happened, she was in that area to try and encourage motorists to drive safely because of the volumes of traffic that usually occur during Easter times in that part of the town. She has, of course, sent her condolences to the families and, of course, is urging the drivers to always be extra careful, be extra vigilant, not to speed, and of course to make sure that they arrive alive wherever they are going. She has also said authorities will now start thorough investigations to find out what exactly happened.
That was reporter Tuso Kumalo speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu has established a task force to find immediate solutions to the economic challenges the country is facing. The president gave members of the committee 2 weeks to provide the answers, but critics say the prevailing economic difficulties are self-inflicted. However, the administration contends that the economic measures are necessary to improve the health of the economy in the long run. For reaction about the economic task force, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Ibrahim Momo, a political analyst in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
I think it's an attempt, you know, to take action. You know, to do nothing would not be an option if you have a challenge, economic challenges. So it's an attempt by the president, you know, to try to resolve the different challenges the country is facing on the economic front. And it's a wide-ranging committee. It has the president himself as chairman, working out a solution out of the economic challenges that this country is grappling with.
How are people reacting to this? Because some of their criticism is that the current economic challenges are self-inflicted, following the removal of the fuel subsidy, the devaluation of the naira or the local currency led to some of these economic challenges Nigerians are facing.
First of all, the reaction has been one of mixed feelings. You know, there are some who are applauding the move because they feel that the president is indeed doing all he can to take the country out of the woods economically. But there are some who are also criticizing, like you have rightly pointed out, that yes, the level of challenges the economy is grappling with were essentially a direct product of the policy reforms that this government put in place. There were no stopgap measures. There were no palliatives, front-loaded, to ensure that the most vulnerable do not suffer unduly. So people are saying that it's like you created a challenge and then you are seeking, you're not doing some walk around to try to. So there's a lot of criticisms, across the spectrum of society. People are even saying that if the president is serious about changing or reforming or ameliorating the suffering of people, he could as well revise the policies, because it was those policies that led to the economic challenges. So if you want to really stop it, why not revise the policy?
I understand the government has argued that reforming the economy is essential for the future of the country. However, Nigerians are saying they are more impoverished, there's no food, prices of goods and services have sharply increased, impoverishing a lot of people. So do you think this is a temporary difficulty that will lead to a better outcome?
The policies have led to immense suffering. And so you expect that those who are the receiving end of these policies, those who are suffering as a result of these policies, would have to raise their voice. For example, in the public sector, the federal government has put in place a stopgap measure of 35,000 naira, the local currency, 35,000 naira of local currency, as additional income for federal employees. Those are the state level, and indeed the local government employees are not beneficiaries of this kind of a stopgap measure.
That was political analyst Ibrahim Momo in Abuja, Nigeria, speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, March 29th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A member of the Togolese Diaspora Coalition is calling on Togolese to turn out in large numbers on April 20th and vote out members of parliament who approved a new constitution without first holding a referendum. According to the Associated Press, the new constitution approved this week gives parliament the power to choose the president without election. It also increases presidential terms from 5 to 6 years. This makes it likely that President Paul Nasibwe would be re-elected when his mandate expires in 2025. Bridget Akuvi Amigambi is a member of the board of Sinagi Togo, a Togolese diaspora organization in Europe. She tells me President Nasibwe should not approve the constitution because it infringes on the right of all citizens to choose their president.
The purpose of the protest is that the constitutional change that has been done a few days ago is unconstitutional, is an infringement of the current constitution, and many infringements have been recorded. The first one is because the National Assembly that made that change of constitutional law is out of its term. Its term ended end of December last year. And there are articles of the Constitution, Article 144, which says that no change of the Constitution cannot occur when the Assembly is during an interim period. Another article of the Constitution, Article 59, says that any change of presidential status or presidential term limit or anything that is about the constitutional provisions around the president cannot be done otherwise than by a referendum. And there were no referendum, just the assembly decided to change the law, whereas they were out of term.
Is it my understanding that the new constitution limits the number of years that the president can stay in power, or does it increase the presidential term of office?
It's a complete change of regime. They say it's now a parliamentary regime instead of a presidential one. And there are two major changes. The first one is that the president will not be elected anymore by vote. The president will be elected by parliament members only. The second change is that the president will have no power. He will be just like he'll be in power for 1 term, 6 years long, but he will be the president of the party that will have the majority at the assembly. And as long as his party will have the majority at the National Assembly, he will be the chief of the government, and he could be there forever. He can stay in power forever.
Was there a constitutional referendum or debate before this came to pass?
No, not at all. The law has been introduced to the assembly by end of January. It went before the law commission last week and submitted to the plenary, the gathering of the assembly one day, and at 9 before midnight it was voted. There were no debate at all.
So if the opposition said they're going to protest, when do you plan to start the protest?
Yesterday there were a press conference to explain to the press what is going on and all the infringement that has affected the protest. And this conference press has been forbidden. So now, as we are going to a legislative election on the 20th of April, this could be the only way to protest, because the electoral campaign will be 2 weeks before that election. This election will be turned into the referendum against the unlawful constitution that has been given to Togo.
Besides protest, as you mentioned, the elections are coming up in April. What other options are available to the opposition?
The other option available to the opposition is to make sure that the Togolese people goes to poll and vote massively against the candidate of the parties that has been in the parliament today, which are those who has made this constitutional change to send them out of the National Assembly and change the law and revert back to the constitution that was in place before what they have done. And a constitution cannot be changed that way overnight without any debate of the people.
Bridget Akuvi Amigambi is a member of the board of Senagi Togo, a Togolese diaspora organization in Europe. She was speaking with us from Paris, France. For most pregnant women in the slums of Nairobi, ultrasound services are an unaffordable luxury. Now, a Kenyan healthcare business is using portable, low-cost ultrasound systems to give expecting mothers a chance to see their babies and detect any health problems before the delivery day. Victoria Amuga reports from Nairobi.
Sophia Ameida is looking at her fetus for the first time at this clinic in Kenya's Mukuru Kwa Ruben slum. Ameida is due in a few weeks. She says getting an ultrasound is critical for her because her first baby was delivered by cesarean section.
They could not tell how the baby was positioned. At the time of my delivery, the baby was still way up and was not moving down at all, so I had to go for surgery.
For most women in Kenyan slums, often called informal settlements, this type of medical technology is out of reach. One session can cost as much as $60. But with a relatively new ultrasound device called a butterfly probe, patients like Ameida can get an ultrasound for just $10. The device is designed by the US-based health tech company Butterfly Network. The probe can connect to a tablet or a mobile phone, making it portable and easy to use for sonographers like Alfred Kibet.
It enables you to reduce the cost of doing ultrasound, because you see with the other traditional machines, ultrasound machines, they are quite expensive, and again the other components involved, like you need a printer, yeah, a special printer. But with it, you can just store the images and then you can print with a regular printer.
Healthcare companies like Access Afia are partnering to provide the devices to clinics, especially in densely populated areas. The goal is to close the gap of affordable healthcare, says Access Afia's finance director, Danny McCabe.
They don't need to be focused on how do I get a payback
immediately on this machine and be focused on, hey, how do I make the highest price possible for these machines? You can be focused on providing the best level of care and then working with us to make sure there's enough foot traffic here to make sure that at the end of the day, everyone's able to make their money back on the machine.
Kenya has among the world's highest rates of maternal deaths, according to UN figures. Nurse midwife Millie Karina says ultrasounds can help to detect and avert most difficulties at birth, like when a woman is carrying twins.
Sometimes I found that we're in labor with a mom, but we didn't know there were two. We thought it was one, but there are two. So that can complicate things a little bit for the mom, not knowing. Number two, mothers have lost pregnancies because the placenta was insufficient. And it could something that could have been picked up really early, but unfortunately, it happens.
Kenyan healthcare providers believe that lower costs of medical technologies like ultrasound will help to lower infant and maternal death. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with football. Africa's Premier Club competition, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederations Cup, will return this weekend as the quarterfinals of both competitions, 2023-2024 season, officially resumes on Friday, March the 29th. Tanzania will be the center of African football attention this weekend as two of their biggest clubs, Simba AC as well as Young Africans FC, welcome two gold medalists in reigning champions, Al-Hakli SC, as well as Mamelodi Sundowns FC of South Africa. The defending champions will face Simba AC on Friday, while Young Africans will play host the South Africans Mamelodi Sundowns on Saturday. South Africa sports journalist Njabulo Ngidi says the Sundowns versus Young African fixture will be a tricky tie.
Going to Tanzania is going to be tricky, but I think Sundowns now, in terms of everything they've gone through, I mean, going to Lubumbashi, Casablanca and Cairo, this isn't a venue that really intimidates them.
In Lubumbashi, Angola's Petro de Luanda will have a tough outing when they take on former champions TP Mazembe, who are yearning for continental glory since their 2015 feat. Later on in the evening, Ivorian powerhouse ASEC Mimosa will take on Osporan Sportive de Tunis to round up the first leg of the two-legged quarterfinals of the CAF Champions League. In the CAF Confederations Cup, Nigeria's Rivers United will take on defending champions USM Alger, while Ghana's Dreams FC will be away to Mali's Stade de Malien, who last lifted the title in 2009. Former champions RS Bakane are looking at reclaiming the title they lost due to USMA as they travel to Libya to take on the unpredictable Abu Salam. Heading Sunday's fixtures is of course the Egyptian Derby, as 2019 champions Zamalek will be looking at ending a continental trophy drought when they take on newcomers Modern Future FC in what promises to be a highly entertaining affair. Away from football news now, the Kenyan government is planning to extend the World Rally Championships Safari Rally from a 3-day sporting event to 5 days. President William Ruto directed the Ministry of Sports to work with the International Automobile Federation, FIA, and the WRC to make this a reality. He made the remarks on Thursday at the Kenyatta International Convention Center in Nairobi during the flagging off of the 2024 WRC Safari Rally.
Global attention generated by WRC provides a definite and major boost to our economy.
In basketball news, Cote d'Ivoire has been confirmed as host of the Africa Women's Basketball Championship AfroBasket, scheduled to take place in July 2025 in Abidjan. This was announced during FIBA Africa's Central Board meeting for the 2023-2027 circle held in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great weekend. And that's it for this Friday, March 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.